Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Tiger Woods may be the greatest golfer ever. Many credit him as well with being the first to break the color barrier in professional golf, but that is not the case. This week, Talking History's Eileen Dugan sets the record straight by discussing the history of African-American golfers with Marvin Dawkins. But before we get to that, let's take a look at an event that occurred this week in history. Well, blow me down. This week in 1937, spinach growers of Crystal City, Texas, erected a statue of American cartoonist Elsie Seeger's most famous creation, Popeye the Spinach-Eating Sailor. Born in Illinois in 1894, Seeger began his working career as a house and sign painter and as a motion picture projectionist. He took a correspondence course in cartooning and traveled to Chicago, where he got a job on the Herald drawing for Charlie Chaplin comic capers. In 1917, after the Herald ceased publication, Seeger went to New York, where he persuaded the King Features Syndicate to accept his idea for a new comic strip, which eventually appeared in 1919 as Thimble Theater. Initially, the strip dealt largely with the fantastic, zany adventures of Olive Oil, a gawky old maid, Castor Oil, her foolish brother, and Ham Gravy, her boyfriend. Popeye did not appear until 1929, followed by Bluto, the comic strip's most recognizable villain, and J. Wellington Wimpy, the artful freeloader who had a love affair with hamburgers. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, after 2 years of controversy that brought international attention and criticism, the Kansas State Board of Education recently voted 7-3 to approve the return of Charles Darwin's theory of evolution to Kansas's science classrooms. This spring, new science standards, including questions on evolution, will be used in developing tests for students. The new standards will replace those adopted in August 1999, which caused an uproar when the board voted to omit from the science curriculum references to evolutionary concepts as well as the Big Bang theory explaining the origins of the universe. Kansas board members had objected to Darwin's theory on the grounds that it contradicts the biblical account of creation. Disney World, hold on to your hat, a new competitor has arrived in Orlando, Florida, the $16 million Holy Land Experience theme park. Extravagantly designed as a recreation of the Holy Land during the time of Jesus, this attraction has met with considerable criticism from Orlando's Jewish community. Leaders of the Jewish community have accused the theme park of attempting to convert Jews to Christianity, and they have spread the word to Jews worldwide to avoid the park. Advocates of the park argue that the only purpose is to spread the Bible's teaching to people of all faiths. Most of the 25,000 Jews living in Orlando chose to ignore the park's opening, but 800 people of various other denominations paid $17 each to roam the 15-acre park on opening day. This is Talking History. Unless you're an ardent golf fan, you may not be aware of the struggle between the races that is part of the sport's history. That is the subject of Eileen Dugan's conversation this week with Marvin Dawkins.
Of all the fields of professional sport, perhaps none has a more tranquil image than golf. We think of golf and we think of perfectly manicured courses and beautiful settings, long walks down the fairway, and hushed crowds at the 18th green. But golf has also been a battleground, as evidenced by the struggles of African Americans to become part of the game and to join the ranks of the PGA. What do these battles tell us about issues of race in America and within sport? Why was professional golf one of the last bastions of Jim Crow? With us today to discuss these issues is Dr. Marvin P. Dawkins, Associate Professor of Sociology and member of the Center for Research on Sport and Society at the University of Miami. Professor Dawkins and his fellow sociologist, Graham C. Kinlock of Florida State University, are the co-authors of the book, African American Golfers During the Jim Crow Era. Welcome, Professor Dawkins.
Thank you.
How did you first encounter African American professional golf?
My first encounter with African American professional golf was as a youth growing up in the Deep South in Jacksonville, Florida. And in actuality, I grew up with a professional golfer in my family and did not really know that. that my father was a professional golfer. And he always told us that he was a professional golfer, and there were other black professional golfers, and we always tried to avoid listening to those stories as children. But I really did not become interested in the topic of African-American professional golfers until many years later as a sociologist specializing in race relations. During a summer at Duke University where I was participating in a symposium, an institute dealing with African-American life in the Jim Crow South, and I decided to examine this topic of black professional golfers, just curiously looking through newspapers, black newspapers, and lo and behold, instead of finding one or two black golfers, I found a whole world of black professional golf.
What traditionally were the obstacles which African Americans faced even in learning the game of golf, much less becoming pros?
As many people know, African Americans became interested, became exposed to golf as caddies for white golfers in private country clubs as youth. Exposure to golf, however, as players was quite limited because there were no means by which blacks could play golf. The golf courses were restricted to whites only, and they, for the most part, were not able to play because of the economic barriers. But caddies were permitted to play usually one day a week on Mondays. Mondays was a day for cleaning the courses and preparing them for the week's activities. And so caddies were permitted to go out and swing their clubs. And many of the youth who took it upon themselves to try to play actually began playing and found that, however, they could not move through the cycle to later become pros, and they were relegated to this position of being caddies. So they faced barriers, but the barriers were primarily a part of the overall Jim Crow segregation that existed.
So how did African Americans become professional?
Well, professional might be stretching it a bit, because they were not recognized as professionals by the PGA, the Professional Golfers Association, which was established in 1916. Black golfers, however, in response to discrimination and exclusion, formed their own organization. They formed an organization called the United Golfers Association, the UGA as it was called. And the UGA served as a means by which black golfers could organize themselves and form a network of organizations as well as tournaments. And the UGA, which was formed in 1926, developed also a network of local organizations and local associations through which blacks became exposed to golf. The professional golfers, interestingly, were the former caddies. Many of the caddies who were usually very poor became the instructors, and there were black middle-class blacks who formed social organizations and golf clubs, but they learned how to play largely through these young people who were former caddies, and so the caddies became recognized black pros in the in the UGA and other local organizations of golfers. Therefore, what we had was a development of a professional organization that included both people who played as professionals and as amateurs.
Where did the UGA hold its tournaments, and what kind of purses could the players play for?
The UGA, the first tournament that the UGA held was in Stowe, Massachusetts, on a course that was a private black golf course. But this was not typical. This was more unusual. The first UGA tournaments were held at a golf course that later on gave way to public golf courses. So most UGA tournaments after 1928 were played at public golf courses and a few private black golf courses, mostly in the North. In fact, the first UGA, and in fact the only UGA tournament that was held in the South between 1926 and 1962 was in 1954 in Dallas, Texas. But all the other courses, all of the other tournaments were held in Indiana, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and there was one tournament held in California in 1939. But they were restricted primarily to public courses in the North, with the exception of a few black private golf courses that were developed in the South.
Could these players actually earn a living by playing in these tournaments?
Well, definitely, earning a living was their desire, but very few could. The closest person to being able to earn a living wasn't until the 1950s, and Charlie Siffert, who eventually became the first African American to gain full membership in the PGA. The purses were usually very, very small, $250, $500, $1,000, and during one period in the late 1940s, it appeared that the purses would be substantial for those who would be winners. But this didn't continue, and by the 1950s, we began to see a decline in the purses. But very few golfers, black golfers, could earn their living from playing golf. So for the most part, black golfers relied on those who sought to play golf at the professional level had to rely on second jobs. They had to rely on sponsorship, oftentimes by black entertainers and black celebrities.
One entertainer who became, or a celebrity who became involved in black professional golf was Joe Louis. How did he become an ambassador for African American golf?
World heavyweight boxing champion Joe Louis became an ambassador for black golf, as I called him in my book, by trying to promote interracial competition, that is, between black and white professional golfers. And he tried to stimulate cooperation and interaction and contact, and he did this fairly successfully through two means. One, through his own notoriety, he was able to sponsor a number of black golfers, most notably Ted Rhodes, who is probably recognized as the best golfer of color before Tiger Woods. And he hired Rhodes as his personal golf pro. But even before that, Joe Louis had several other golf, black golfers who he sponsored. But Rhodes probably became most recognized because he felt that Rhodes had the potential, and other golfers, but particularly Rhodes, of competing with white golfers. And Joe Louis was invited to play and had access on many occasions as a guest of many elite whites. And therefore, he tried to use his notoriety to stimulate interest in providing opportunities for black professionals. He also became an ambassador through the establishment of his own tournament during the period from 1941 to 1951. Joe Louis sponsored the Joe Louis Open tournament in Detroit, which became the richest tournament organized by African Americans. In this tournament, while it was just as the UGA National Open tournament, it was a tournament that where black golfers played. Louis tried to stage opportunities for whites to play first through having exhibitions at the tournaments, where he would select two top black pros against white pros who would come to the tournaments for the exhibitions. And these exhibitions were usually the highlight of the tournaments. And what it did, it gave the golf world an opportunity to see how well African American golfers competed against their white counterparts at the professional level. But by 1949, Louis felt that Joe Louis felt that the time was right for a breakthrough to occur in golf, and therefore he invited more participation in the regular tournament. In 1949, the Joe Louis Open tournament was significant in that the runner-up in that tournament was a white pro, and there were several other whites who participated, but the black golfers accorded themselves well, and he felt very confident that the PGA would take this as a signal that just as in baseball, the black golfers would be given the opportunity to participate, but it didn't happen. There continued to be resistance by the PGA to allowing blacks to participate as members of the PGA Tour of America.
Why was the PGA able to resist desegregation for so long?
Well, the PGA, as you know, was a private organization, and from its beginning in 1916, the posture was one of exclusion. And despite not having a restrictive policy, the climate of Jim Crowism made it clear that blacks could not join. In 1943, the PGA formalized this informal exclusion by inserting a clause in their constitution which restricted membership in the PGA to Caucasians only, as it became well known as the Caucasian-only clause. And this clause was not removed until 1961. And when the Caucasian-only clause was removed, under both legal and social pressure, the PGA nevertheless maintained a posture of exclusion despite the formal barrier to black participation being dismantled.
We only have a moment left, but could I ask just one quick question?
Sure.
Do you think there has been a Tiger Woods effect upon African Americans participating in golf?
Well, there has not only been a Tiger Woods effect on the participation of African Americans in golf, there has been a Tiger Woods effect on the participation of youth in golf. I think Tiger Woods has done more for the sport than any single golfer in the history of the sport. He has stimulated an interest in golf and has raised golf to the status, really, of being a national pastime, which it really probably is more than any other sport. Now I think golf, for the first time, actually, it competes with basketball, football, and baseball for African American youth, but for youth in general.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dawkins.
Okay. You're very welcome.
We have been talking with Dr. Marvin P. Dawkins, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Miami and co-author of the book African American Golfers During the Jim Crow Era.
Elder broke an important part of the color barrier in golf over a quarter century ago. Here to tell you about that breakthrough and the importance of Lee Elder to professional golf is Scott Yingle. Yingle, formerly a golf pro, now teaches English at the University of South Alabama. He is currently working on a book about golf and race.
When Tiger Woods won the 1997 Masters Golf Tournament by a record 12 strokes, he ensured that he would be the prohibitive favorite to reign at Augusta National for a decade or more. That he did so nearly 50 years to the day after Jackie Robinson integrated baseball only confirmed that the game of golf may one day look like the rest of America. However, when Fuzzy Zeller jokingly referred to Woods as a boy that same afternoon and urged the new champion not to request fried chicken and collard greens at the next year's champion's dinner, he sadly reminded us that racial insensitivity does not evaporate with the prodigious achievements of a young man of color. This year's Masters marks the 26th anniversary of the breaking of the color barrier at Augusta, golf's hallowed ground in the Old South. Built on a former plantation and retaining an all-white membership until 1990, Augusta long seemed a spectacular garden party open to a privileged few. However, on April 21, 1974, Lee Elder sank an 18-foot putt on the fourth hole of sudden death to capture the Monsanto Open in Pensacola, Florida. With the win, Elder became the first African-American to automatically qualify for the Masters and break through one of the most enduring and symbolic racial barriers in American sport. The victory in Pensacola included an ironic subplot, since Elder had dropped the tournament from his schedule 5 years before because of persistent racial harassment from fans. In fact, until May 1961, the Constitution of the PGA of America limited its membership to, quote, professional golfers of the Caucasian race. And thus, like many of the black touring professionals of the 60s, Elder came to competitive golf relatively late in life, honing his game on the now-forgotten United Golf Association circuit, an itinerant all-black tour that offered tournaments on municipal courses for small purses. Elder dominated the UGA through the mid-60s, once winning 10 straight tournaments, and in 1968 he joined the integrated PGA Tour as a 34-year-old rookie. In the months leading up to his Masters debut, Elder became an unwilling celebrity, appearing on the cover of Sports Illustrated and continually facing questions concerning the gravity of his achievement. In the end, Elder shot 8 over par for his first 2 rounds at Augusta and missed the cut, but took the setback in stride, joking that his wayward shots allowed him to see more of the course's spectacular azaleas and magnolias. Elder made 5 subsequent appearances in the Masters, his best finish a tie for 17th in 1979. He annually competed in the face of death threats on a course in which often the only other African Americans were the familiar black caddies in their stark white overalls. That the best golfer on the planet today is a young man of mixed race parentage is something of a tribute to pioneers like Elder, Charlie Sifford, Kenny Rhodes, and others, black men who excelled in a sport that took pride in its sense of decorum, but long ignored its greatest oversight.
You've been listening to Scott Yingle, professor of English at the University of South Alabama and the author of a forthcoming book on golf and race. This is Talking History. continuing on our theme of golf, for our site of the week, we call to your attention a house that pays tribute to the history and players of the game. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Golf fans everywhere should pay a visit to the Golf House in Far Hills, New Jersey. It is the headquarters of the U.S. Golf Association and houses many interesting artifacts. You'll see Bobby Jones's famous putter, as well as the ball with which he won the U.S. Amateur in 1930. The museum also features an exhibit on golf great Ben Hogan and the one iron with which he made one of the most famous shots in history to force a playoff at the 1950 U.S. Open. Along with displays devoted to the game and its history, you can also visit a reproduction of a clubmaker's studio, a theater that shows classic golf footage, and a library. And nearby at the Research and Test Center, you will find the legendary ball and club testing machine Iron Byron, and now the latest gizmo, the Wind Tunnel, among others. For more information, contact the Golf House in Far Hills, New Jersey.
Turning to our list of coming attractions, we may learn as much about history from the cinema as from any other source, except Talking History, of course. But while you know the history you hear on this show is accurate, what about the history you see on the large screen? During the week of April 10th, as part of its History's Mysteries series, the History Channel's Arthur Kent hosts a four-part series that explores the true story behind the events chronicled in four major Hollywood historical films. On April 10th, he looks at the insurrection aboard the HMS Bounty in 1789. On April 11th, he examines the true story of Scottish national hero William Wallace, the subject of the movie Braveheart. On April 12th, Kent takes a look at the Untouchables version of Prohibition Chicago and colorful figures represented on the screen like Elliot Ness and Al Capone. The series concludes on April 13th when Kent goes in search of the spooky origins of the cursed town of Amityville, Long Island, including an interview with the family that lived in the house and had the haunting experience upon which the film was based. Be sure to check your local listings for exact showtimes. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you will join us next time. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. Thank you.